All right. Hi, everybody. This is Joanne Manister, Science Goddess on Twitter with Read Science. And I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Jeff Schomeyer. And today we will be talking to Mara. Okay. I'm so sorry to ask you how you say your name.
What Vistendahl.
Vistendahl. Vistendahl. Yeah. Okay. I sort of thought that might be it, but why not? Why not be thorough? So with Mara Vistendahl, who is the author of several books, and let's see. So I will start with the first book of hers that I read before I read your bio. I read her book, Unnatural Selection. It was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, which you don't find out till they announce the Pulitzer Prize, right?
Yes.
So this is choosing boys over girls and the consequences of a world full of men. I don't know how I ended up with this book, if someone sent it to me, or I just thought that looks interesting. But I really enjoyed it, and it certainly deserves its place on the finalist of Pulitzer Prize. Mm. So, but we are going to. You also have a long form story that's in an ebook, and I read it too, and I enjoyed it. Called "And the City Swallowed Them," and I remember it was about a model, and I can't remember much else. It was sort of like a
Canadian model who was murdered in Shanghai, and there's a lot of intrigue around the crime, and there's an interesting twist at the end.
Right. So it's been a while since I read that one, but today we are going to talk about her book, The Scientist and the Spy, A True Story of China, the FBI, and Industrial Espionage. Now, I've mentioned all of her books, but I haven't talked much about what else she do and all the other wonderful places you get to write about science. So Mara Vistendahl covered China's renaissance in science and technology as a correspondent for Science in Shanghai. She has also written for The Atlantic, Popular Science, and Wired. She's the author of the books I've mentioned. You were a finalist for the General Nonfiction for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Excellent. Anyway, a proficient Mandarin speaker and a former national fellow at New America, she lived in China for 8 years and now resides in Minneapolis with her family. So we are so glad you're here. And normally at this point, I would have Jeff take over, but I thought I would ask this very obvious question. What's it like to have published a book and compete with COVID-19 pandemics?
Well, it's been interesting. My book launched in early February, and that was around the same time that everyone in the United States was starting to talk about what was happening in China. And, you know, because I lived there for many years and know many journalists there, and that was a natural readership for the book. It did make it difficult to get publicity in some ways, but on the other hand, there were a lot of people who were suddenly stuck at home who did start reading and listening to audiobooks. And, you know, it's possible that we'll see the same thing happen in the United States. Although I guess the question here is how strict the measures taken by various cities and states will be. It was good and bad. And right now we're at this very unusual place where, you know, not just authors are affected, but almost anybody promoting anything and, you know, doing any sort of work. And so spring events have been canceled. Independent bookstores are trying to come up with interesting ways to still sell books and get people talking about books. And we'll see. You know, in China, people came up with a lot of innovative ways to deal with the lockdown and deal with being under quarantine. And maybe some of that will happen here.
Oh, you know what, though? If authors start talking about their books at online instead of at bookstores I'm nowhere near, I would tune in. I absolutely would. So yeah, I'd say go for it. You know, this could increase your audience a little bit more even.
So hopefully.
Great. Well, Jeff, why don't we start talking about Mara's book?
The official beginning.
The official beginning.
Yeah, such as it is. this story, this beautifully reported story that you've given us is bizarre and pretty unbelievable story about corn breeding and international espionage. And it's just a remarkable story. And at one point, very much toward the end, where I think you were starting to look back on it, you wrote, "At times, it seemed to me that Mark Bettern, Robert Moe, and Kevin Montgomery were merely actors in a play directed by someone else." And I could see why you said that. And I thought this might give us a starting point rather than, you know, where do you begin to tell the story? Perhaps thinking of it as a play, you might give us the short biography of what each one of these three actors, what his role is in this story. And then we can figure out whether you think the story is a tragedy or a comedy, perhaps.
Sure.
But that might give us a way to start talking about the
sort
of ordinary but incredible goings on in this, in this plot.
It's interesting that you picked out those lines. I wrote that after having structured the book in three acts, and you know, I was lucky enough that the story lent itself to being structured that way because it is a true story, and there were a lot of interesting twists and turns. And part of me, what drew me to the story was the fact that all of the characters were complex, so nobody was either just good or bad, and it wasn't a typical true crime story in the sense you have this good guy and a bad guy. And my hope is that it makes readers think about these issues in different ways.
None of them seemed like the mastermind of the operation either.
Right. True.
Yeah. They seemed like people.
Yeah. Well, so the other thing that drew me to the story is I was living in China working for Science when I read about this man, Robert Moore, who had been found near a cornfield in Iowa. It was a Monsanto field.
Yep.
And his appearance there set off this massive FBI investigation. And it was a trade secrets theft investigation, spanned several years. It involved, you know, everything from car chases to the FBI actually flying surveillance planes overhead at one point. So just really massive response. And part of what drew me to that story was that it's just one of dozens of such cases that have played out over the past few years involving scientists with ties to China. And so looking at that case seemed a way to get at this larger issue of what's going on with these investigations and with the charges that are being brought almost weekly involving scientists from China.
Now, I think it was Kevin, I wrote down a note at one point, and I wondered whether he was more tragic or quixotic. I thought
he was my favorite.
He's very likable.
Yes. So there are three main characters. Yeah. Robert Moore, he's a Chinese-born engineer who lived in Florida.
A naturalized
his family. He did not become a U.S. citizen, but his wife and his children were born here.
Right.
In many ways, felt like an American. Was found near this cornfield. The second character is the FBI agent who then hears about this incident and takes on the case and ends up overseeing dozens of agents in multiple states and directing this immense operation. And then the third character is the one you mentioned, Kevin, who is a seed breeder and a farmer from Illinois, who ends up kind of caught in the middle of this whole operation. He was hired as a consultant by Robert's company to do what he thought was legitimate work. And then he ends up, one day the FBI knocks on his door and says, you know, what have you been doing dealing with this Chinese company? And he ends up becoming an informant for the FBI. I should add that he had no awareness of.
I was going to say he was clueless. Yeah. He was like,
right.
You know, so in some of the interviews early on with the companies, like, That's an odd question. Why would they ask that question, you know?
He did have his doubts. And so Robert's company was called DBN. Mm-hmm. It's a Beijing agricultural company. Robert studied thermodynamics, so nothing to do with agriculture, but had this kind of classic academic story where after he finished his second PhD, he failed to find a tenure track position. And so he, you know, ended up turning to a life of crime. It wasn't that direct.
But
only academics.
But in that,
really funny. But
in that tragic comedy sort of way, he got to it sort of one small step at a time, and then became engulfed pretty much before. Thinking of Kevin, I'm sorry, but there's this huge contrast too, because Kevin was this guy who likes breeding and he crosses seeds out in his backyard, mm-hmm. hoping that he can sell them sometime to China. And so he gets involved, and lurking behind them is DBN in China and Monsanto and Pioneer Seed back here that are like the hugest agricultural conglomerates in the world. And so mm-hmm. when you say, so here was Mark, the FBI agent out in the middle of Iowa, and before you know it, we've got helicopters surveying half the state and dozens.
Yeah, actual airplanes.
Dark airplanes and things. It's like, and the whole thing just seems to get monstrously out of hand.
Yes.
Awfully easily somehow.
Yeah. And, you know, I think out of hand on both sides. Yeah. So on the one hand, so DBN's scheme to steal corn, and I should go just to, Robert didn't immediately turn to a life of crime. What happened was he found this job with this agricultural company through
his brother-in-law.
Yes. So through nepotism, he gets this job. He's doing at first legal work, sourcing animal feed from the U.S., brokering business deals, you know, for this Beijing company to acquire companies in the West. And then little by little, his work becomes more questionable. And his boss in Beijing gets this idea to steal seeds from mm-hmm. the competition and then reverse engineer them back in China. And so that's when he ends up embroiled in this international agricultural espionage operation. Mm-hmm. But it is, I should say, it was somewhat out of hand at some point, but it was also fairly harebrained and haphazard.
Each small step seemed like just a small step, and it's like, and then before you know it, the scheme for trying to steal these seeds from Monsanto and Pioneer, basically, you made the important observation that research takes a long time and theft doesn't.
That's right. I mean, there are a number of people who research this issue of whether IP theft makes sense in the long run. And for most companies, it's not a great long-term strategy because mm-hmm. you steal a technology and then 5 years later, that technology is going to be out of date. And unless you have the research staff to update it with seeds, that's quite difficult. You build up the IP over many years. So unless you have that research staff in place, you're going to have to steal the technology again or, you know, come up with some other way to get it. But in the short term, it can be a way to get a leg up on the competition.
Yeah.
And a lot of companies in China have rather short-term goals because, mm-hmm. you know, the nature of the economy and the government and so forth.
I'm hoping that people listening are starting to piece together some idea of what the story is about, because it's, without reading the entire book, it's awfully hard to get the overview of all these mm-hmm. players involved, the what ends up being this intellectual property, international spying thing to steal the IP from these seed breeds. But that is a huge, huge, huge thing for Monsanto and Pioneer to maintain their control over these seeds too, isn't it? Something like at one point 85% of the U.S.'s corn mm-hmm. is Monsanto corn.
Oh, so now, yeah, it's now close to 80%. That is
80%.
Pioneer and DuPont and Monsanto. But actually, but those yeah, companies but have that, also merged with others. Corn, so, yeah, that's another.
We think of those as, you know, little Iowa family farmers, but we're talking a major yeah. agribusiness and billions of dollars here.
Oh, right, right. And so that was an issue that I was drawn to the story because the players in it were so complex. And part of that was that Monsanto is an unlikely victim in any story. Yes. You know, for many people, Monsanto, even people don't know about the industry, Monsanto still evokes a kind of mm-hmm. certain sort of association. But, you know, once I started doing more reporting and talking to farmers, talking to experts on the seed industry, and also to IP lawyers, I realized that there's this other story, which is that companies like Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer, which are now Dow DuPont and mm-hmm. Bayer, acquired Monsanto,
Bayer, yeah.
They spend massive amounts trying to protect their IP and also trying to kind of shut out other players in the market. And as they've gotten bigger, they have spent less and less as a proportion of sales on research. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the bottom line, what's the best way to protect research and innovation in America? Yeah. You know, guarding against IP theft is one thing, but we also have to think about this other issue, which is consolidation and corporate control. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to wrap all these issues into the book through this and tell it in a, yes. in a still gripping narrative and scene by scene.
Yes.
But because of the different characters I chose, they kind of came out naturally.
Well, yeah.
I think the story of Kevin, for example, raised this issue of corporate mm-hmm. consolidation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I have to say, one of the most amusing things about the book is this image of these Chinese guys wandering through cornfields, actually trying to get seeds, and someone's sitting in the car, the getaway car, more or less. I mean, and the fact that, you know, the guy's probably not wearing a business suit, but the story morphs into he's wearing a Chinese man in a business suit is walking through cornfields. And yeah,
right. There's this kind of game of telephone at the beginning where a farmer spots Robert's colleague in the field, calls the police. It says, you know, the guy in the field's wearing like polo shirt and
yeah.
pants
and he's suspicious.
Turns into a suit and his ethnicity comes into play quite early on, which, you know, has been an issue in other investigations that the FBI has brought. And so, you know, partly because the case had all these kind of weird moments, and I had a lot of visibility into those moments because yes. it dragged on in it didn't go to trial, but it dragged on in court mm-hmm. in discovery phase for several years. And so it had transcripts of what the various characters were saying to each other, like as they were driving across the Midwest looking for corn, what the FBI agent was saying to to his colleagues at various points. So yes. it was a remarkable degree of visibility, and I feel, you know, fortunate yeah. that I had that.
And it all seems like the most ridiculous plot that no one would ever believe if they saw it in a movie.
Yeah, I actually had it. There was one Amazon review where the guy wrote, you know, the dialogue is kind of weird. And this just doesn't seem believable. And I think maybe he didn't realize that it was a nonfiction book. So, well, I don't know. Truth is stranger than fiction.
This is a good yeah. a good point before I hand back to Joanne, because I wanted to tell you how much I appreciated your note about the sources at the end, where you very carefully described what you were working with, where all the things like the thoughts that you wrote down, the quotations that you used, how you could source them all to various people that you either talked to or direct statements in discovery and the various other things, and how you managed all of that so that at least the reader finds out at the end that all those things you say you couldn't imagine actually happened. actually happened, and you've got the goods on them. That was a very helpful note, I thought, and lent a special use to your reporting on this, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. There were a lot of the scenes I could reconstruct from actual documents where, you know, had transcriptions of the bugs that were placed in the cars as people were driving around corn area, cornfields, and in other places, I was able to reconstruct the dialogue, like through extensive interviews and so forth, and tried wherever possible to do that by interviewing all the different parties right. in the scene, all the people who were involved. And then I, in the notes, indicated which method I used.
Because and you've talked quite a bit to Robert Moe himself about yes. these things too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
He was forthcoming and yeah. And just driving around the cornfields of Iowa, stopping occasionally to look in cornfields wearing inappropriate clothing and a car being bugged and talking about how all these things they're doing is illegal. Just is incredible.
Yes. You know, at the same time. Yeah.
And yet normal.
Well, right. So what I learned from talking with Kevin, other seed breeders, is that in some ways this is just business as usual mm-hmm. for the seed industry, and the companies like Monsanto and Pioneer have been stealing IP from each other for years, or accusing each other of stealing it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, there used to be something called flashlight breeding
yes.
where breeders would actually go out into the, I don't know if they would go at night, but the implications that they go out into the competitors' fields and dig up the seeds out of the ground. So, you know, in many ways, this is an old method. The difference is that because it's a case involving a Chinese company,
yes.
it carries criminal charges, and people go to prison for many years in some cases. Robert Moe did end up going to prison, and there have been other cases where people have gotten terms of over 10 years. And so there's been this big shift in the way we deal with those kind of violations.
Another important aspect that you brought up that this demonstrates is like, this used to be the sort of thing that was handled as a civil court infraction. And is it really appropriate to be using all the agents of the FBI for this intercompany spat about mm-hmm. intellectual property that involves Chinese company and American companies would bother some people. I think it bothers me some, but that has changed. That's from recent times, from 1999, was it?
96, yeah.
Yeah, where it suddenly became a federal offense to do these things, probably thanks to lots of lobbying dollars from Monsanto at the time.
Well, I don't know. I wasn't able to prove that.
Yeah,
but there were a number of corporations that pushed for trade secret stuff to be made into a federal crime.
Yeah.
You know, there were other reasons too. It was becoming a lot easier to steal IP because of the internet. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you had, because of the end of the Cold War, you had a lot of agents out of work who went to mm-hmm. then work for corporations, and also people in the intelligence community who wanted a reason to hang on to their jobs. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
And so, you know, there was a push to kind of define a new mission. But really, things have escalated in the past 2 years under the Trump DOJ. Mm-hmm. And there's something called the China Initiative now, where they are bringing cases almost weekly. And it'll be interesting to see to what degree economic slowdown and COVID-19 will affect that. You know, this is part of a kind of general shift in the way that in U.S.-China relations, and to some degree, the outbreak is driving a rift.
Interesting. So I was really grateful that actually you had devoted part of the book to talk about some of the other, it's not exactly industrial espionage, but scientific. They're worried that Chinese scientists who have come here are sealing scientific secrets to make sure they get back. And that, you know, we're having a lot of Chinese scientists being sent home or put in jail for, you know, their, you know, or even just being sent home because of suspicion that they may be trying to get biomedical secrets or other, you know,
Should we mention the thousand secret grains of sand theory at this point?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm happy to talk about that. You know, as I went deeper into this case of Robert Moe and started talking to experts on, I realized that I needed to understand the way that the FBI has historically handled these investigations. There are a lot of concerns now within the community of ethnic Chinese and Chinese American scientists in the US and just the general community of scientists that people are being singled out unfairly, that there's racial profiling. And, you know, even though Robert Moe in his case clearly committed the crime, those issues all kind of swirled around in the background. So if you go back to the 1990s, and this theory still shapes investigations today, there is this idea that China used this thousand grains of sand approach to spying. And so that was the notion that if intelligence collection were aimed at determining the composition of sand on a beach, that the US and Russia would use these kind of James Bond-like tactics to go, you know, they would send stealth missions or they would scan, they would, you know, use scanners to determine the composition of the scan of the sand, sorry, and do this all in the dead of night. And whereas China would send thousands of people to the beach, they would each take home their towels at the end of the day and shake out their towels, and they would somehow capture the sand that way. I mean, when I first read about that theory, I thought, that is, it seems specious for a number of reasons. One is that it so clearly harkens back to the notion of like of yellow peril and hordes of, like, it's such a fraught idea. The second is that having lived in China, you know, it's a country with a bureaucracy that never functions as well as you would assume. Yeah. And so this idea that somehow
they could organize so many people to go collect little bits and bring it back, right?
So I mean, there's no doubt that now there is this priority within the Chinese Communist Party on obtaining technology. But it isn't so much that the government's like sending spies out in most cases and saying, you know, go forth and steal corn. Instead, it's that companies like DBN know that there will be few repercussions or no repercussions if they do steal something. And this is a very different picture. You know, China does have a professional spying apparatus, but when it comes to technology, it's typically much more distributed. And that's definitely the case with the corn theft.
And it was convenient for xenophobes at the FBI and things who wanted to have people to investigate and to blame people for something.
Well, it's a very kind of pat theory. It did influence the investigation of Wen Ho Li, the Los Alamos scientist who was held in solitary confinement for a number of months in 1999, and then was ultimately cleared of most of the charges against him. You know, that's a case that still is memorable it's front and center in many people's minds today, especially Chinese American scientists who went through that period, and now they're seeing many, many cases brought involving their colleagues. And there have been recent cases where people were arrested and then later, like a few months later, it turned out that the government got the science wrong in the charges. And so the charges were dropped. So that is a real risk because these are very often very complex technologies. Even if you look at something like seed breeding, it's complex. Mm-hmm. The structure of the Chinese government is complex. And so you have FBI agents who are tasked with deciphering all of this. And if you add in this lens of possible ethnic bias, you can end up making mistakes.
Well, and then, the Los Alamos case, sorry, is this is a parenthesis, I promise. The Los Alamos case was familiar because I was a career physicist for a while and just made it to the pages of Physics Today where we hear about these sorts of things. And I think for most physicists, it's very easy to understand that sometimes you take work home. Sometimes you're not always thinking about security and things. You're just trying to get the work done. And there's always the feeling that it's easy to have the feeling that everything you do could be misconstrued as spying.
Yeah. I mean, so still with the Wen Houli case, that seems to be the one that provokes the most debate even today. There have been a number of people who called me up after the book came out to say, look, he was guilty. And I think, he did not get a fair shake. So let's debate whether he was guilty, like if he had gotten a fair trial and a fair investigation, without his name being leaked to the New York Times, ahead of even being charged with anything, then we might be able to talk about it. But ultimately that case was based on a faulty assumption, which was that China had obtained nuclear secrets, and there was then this assumption that they had to have come from ethnic Chinese scientist within a U.S. lab. And, there are several errors that were made along the way.
And Americans, as we saw in the early 50s, Americans seemed very good at imagining those sorts of things and figuring that there's no way the Soviets could have figured out at all how to build an atom bomb, even though scientists would say, of course they could. It's not that hard to understand. The technology is difficult.
Right. So we do have this tendency to assume when an adversary gets a technology, just assume that it is necessarily the product of theft and not that they could have developed it on their own. Or, somebody told me that the really difficult thing is to create the technology the first time. So once it's the act of imagining it.
You know it can be done.
Right.
It makes a vast difference. Yeah.
Right. So once the Americans have something, and then the Russians and Chinese are much more easily able to follow it simply because it's right.
Yeah.
It exists. Yeah. So go ahead. I'll let you finish your thought.
No, just to go back to the issue of physics, there's another case involving a physicist, and that's the case of Xiaoxing Xi, who was the interim head of the physics department at Temple University in Philadelphia.
Yes.
So he was arrested he says at gunpoint. And then several months later, several experts in his field, including the person who invented the device that he was accused of trying to transfer to China, submitted affidavits saying, this case is completely absurd, unfounded. And so the charges were dropped in this case.
Right. And I think there was some difficulty with the Robert Moe case in that, how can we prove these seeds had the proprietary information if DuPont and Monsanto aren't going to share their proprietary information?
Right. I mean, that is the strange wrinkle in these cases that...
So they're not going to share. They don't want to share. But then again, they want to say, yes, they stole ours. Well, how can we show? We're not going to say that.
Yeah, I can see from the company's perspective too. They're trying to protect their IP, so they don't want it to leak out during trial.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you're trying to prove something was stolen, you need to have some visibility in the IP. I think the issue that then comes up is that it's enough to show that somebody intended to steal technology, and that they thought it was proprietary, and so that's a way to get around the question of whether it actually was.
Yeah, I just imagine this whole courtroom full of lawyers and lawyers on top of lawyers, you know?
Yeah, a lot of lawyers involved.
I had the feeling while I was reading this that you had to learn how to do lots of things like get at court documents that you'd never had to do before. So I'm wondering in a general way about, you know, your experience and personally in writing this book and doing the research about all the things that you learned and experiences that you had and what that was like. It's kind of a softball question, but.
I think it's a good question.
Still, it's interesting.
I think it is interesting.
Yeah, well, so I was living in China when I started doing the research and then moved to the US and back to the Midwest. And I lived in China for most of my career as a journalist. So I had a lot of experience in, you know, trying to get information out of Chinese companies and out of the government, trying to find statistics such as they are there. And moving back to the US, I think the beautiful thing was being able to use the Freedom of Information Act to get information. I did manage to get quite a few pages on an historic FBI program that was targeting Chinese American scientists. Mm-hmm. And that's something I obtained using FOIA. Mm-hmm. The court documents and, you know, being able to show up in court. One of the previous books that you mentioned was about a court case that was tried in China. And, you know, by contrast, I was able to find out a bit about what happened in that courtroom, but the records are not public. And so, you know, moving back here, I really came to appreciate all of those tools that are available to journalists and to use them. And when I placed several different FOIA requests for this program, I'd heard from a source that there is a suspicion that in the 60s and 70s, Chinese American scientists were widely targeted for reasons that were fairly specious, and including U.S. citizens, I should say. So, you know, this is a time when tensions with China were running high, but these were people who had been in the U.S. for years, had not even left. And and so I FOIA'd those documents, and then it took 2 years to get the final batch, but they did come in.
But you did, yes.
Yeah. So I was... curious, since you lived in China and you covered science and technology in China and also in the U.S., now China's really doing a big push to get some major collaboration or to woo scientists from the United States into China, you know, offering them a good salary, offering them houses, offering so that they can set up these new institutes for research and things like that. So I'm wondering what's going on in the mind in China. Do they really believe that, you know, the West holds a lot of information? Are they so far behind, or is this another shortcut? Like, yeah, what are they thinking in doing all of this to bring scientists over?
Well, a lot of countries have talent programs. The difference with the Chinese one is that it's overseen by the Chinese Communist Party. And I think that's one of the reasons why the FBI has attached special significance to it. But interestingly, you know, when I was working in China, I reported several different stories on that program. It's called the Thousand Talents Program. Mm-hmm. And we'd always reported them from this angle of people getting these grants and then not showing up in China. And so it was this pretty unsuccessful effort to get talent to return to China. And what happened was that there were a number of scholars, and this includes both ethnic Chinese and non-ethnic Chinese, you know, people like Charles Lieber, the former head of the chemistry department at Harvard, who would take the grant money from China and not report it to the US institutions. And then they would also not show up in China, typically.
Interesting.
Hotshots who the program is directed at getting them to settle down in China, but it really never achieved that goal for various reasons. There's no tenure. The quality of life and just general kind of cronyism within Chinese institutions. And so the FBI becomes concerned because it's tied to the CCP, and it is also, of course, a violation of NIH policy to be, accepting money from the U.S. government and then going to China and accepting money from the Chinese government and not reporting it. So it's definitely something that the NIH needs to address. But in the past few years, what's happened is that the FBI has worked together with the NIH and they've gone into institutions, sometimes shut down labs, put researchers on leave. In some cases, like the Charles Lieber case, brought criminal charges. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear which of those tools are effective. Because the shutting, I went, so in the book, Robert Mo develops an illness and ends up getting treatment at MD Anderson Center in Houston. And that's one of the centers that was the subject of this big FBI.
I remember that.
So that development in his own personal story seemed like a way to work in that larger story of this crackdown on grant fraud. So I went to Houston, talked to a number of researchers there, and tried to piece together what the story was. And the shutting down of labs and then putting people on leave had created just an enormous disruption. And among many researchers, this feeling like they were being singled out because of their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And in the end, no criminal charges were brought. Many people did leave for China. Some of them resigned. Some were pushed out, and some, it just seems like they were fed up with the kind of general atmosphere. And so, you know, ironically, if the goal is to keep researchers in the United States, and if we're in a battle with China for talent, this method of going in with these sort of heavy-handed investigations seems to be pushing people back to China.
I do wonder.
Relations, we should deal with them. But there are a lot of people saying, well, can we deal with this in a different way?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because I know so many Chinese academics, you know, they are here for whatever reason. Maybe they came to school in the U.S. and then decided to stay. You know, they did grad school here and then decided to continue and stay. I do wonder what's going on in everybody's heads, like, is the atmosphere so bad that I should return or not?
Well, the number of people who've committed fraud or IP theft is, it's a very small proportion of the overall research population. And so much of the U.S. research force is foreign born, and much of it is ethnic Chinese. And so we need to figure out how to... if we're going to address the issue of IP theft, we need to do it in a way that makes people feel welcome and like they are not being targeted unfairly.
Right. So I went to college in Iowa, and so the cornfields are familiar, but then also more in that as this story blossoms and gets out of control, it embroils the one-time governor of Iowa who became the ambassador to China because he was previously acquainted, if not friendly, with Xi Jinping.
Xi Jinping.
Thank you. And he's concerned for something that everyone can understand. It's like, I don't want this China thing to become some general hate China thing, because schools like one I went to in Iowa depend on a stream of Chinese students who can pay the tuition.
Right.
There are threads everywhere.
Right. And I mean, so it shows the degree to which we're connected to China in many ways. And so, you know, it's complex. So these investigations involving Chinese scientists, they'd started to play out under the Obama DOJ. But then after Trump came into office, brought with him a lot of xenophobia, and you know, appointed a trade advisor who was just extremely hawkish on China, Navarro. And so Trump himself has said at some point that all Chinese students are spies. Mm-hmm. And people in the administration have said things along those lines too.
It's a thousand grains of sand.
Right. Well, so this certainly does not help the general atmosphere. And I think we've seen also in the past few weeks with the outbreak of COVID-19 people are very quick to go to racism.
Yes.
Both the Trump administration, also just average people in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's really alarming. And it's something that, you know, I had seen in these cases that I looked at, but now that is everywhere.
But you did do an excellent job of finding a narrative that was compelling and ridiculous at the same time, that gave you a hook for looking at this amazing number of little interwoven network of threads and all these stories that impinge. It turned out to be surprisingly, I don't know, full-bodied by the end, I thought. And that you could organize your way through that is also quite an achievement, really.
Yeah, I restructured it several times.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how you put that all together. Like, how do I make this all work?
So, I think it was worth the effort.
I used several, you know, I think a really good reference was The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because she weaves together all of these different threads and does it so seamlessly. And she has this historical story that's running through this more contemporary story.
And personal narrative.
Yeah. Evan Ratliff's The Mastermind was another reference that I used. Because that's a really, I mean, he's got this very propulsive, like, international crime story. It's more dramatic in some ways because it involves murder and drugs. Mm-hmm. But there are so many characters in that book that he had to kind of focus it and organize it. And so he has these first person chapters that are, that are dispersed throughout the book, and that kind of anchor the reporting and give the reader a little sense of, like, what journey am I on? And so I found that helpful too.
And you're present in this book, not in a largely forward way, but right. You're there. There's some first person there, and that seems to be something that that's becoming more common in journalism of this type. That I think is a very nice thing.
And actually, I have a question from someone on Facebook, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So he says, you mentioned the subject somewhat earlier, but have there been any recent major cases in which the Chinese legal system did protect foreign or non-China-owned patents, either in the criminal system or the civil system? He's heard a little bit about trademarks, but not about patents.
No, that's a good question. And I don't know the answer to the patent question specifically, because my book was focused on trade secrets, which is sort of the flip side of patents. I do know, I did talk to a number of IP lawyers in China who said that increasingly companies are trying to pursue these issues in Chinese court, and that they're having more success. There have been improvements in the IP regime in China. You know, to some degree, China now has nine of the 20 most valuable tech companies in the world. And as these companies become formidable powers in their own right, they have more IP to protect. And, you know, so that may change. The government's general direction on the way it treats the issue, but, you know, and for the immediate future, I don't see a huge change.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to change subject just a little bit because Jeff brought up about how we have so many Chinese students in the United States. Mm-hmm. And of course I'm at one of the universities that has one of the largest numbers of international students. And I think almost everybody, I did have one student write to me saying, I'm in Wuhan, I cannot get to my class, can you send me your homework? I said, oh, but your class is online with me, so you're good, you can do this. And so with the Chinese students, we rely on that income. so much so to the point that our university actually has an insurance policy in case for some reason Chinese students cannot attend.
Oh, wow.
I guess we're sort of, I don't know, unique in that way, or one of the leaders in doing that, which I thought was interesting. But the other thing, I thought, wow, that's amazing. And I can tell in my non-majors online classes, I have a lot of Chinese students, a lot of international students in general, but a lot of Chinese students because, you know, it's easier to engage with the English if you can go through the lecture several times at your own pace, think about the, you know, timing of an asynchronous session and things like that. But the one issue I seem to run across a lot is that they often don't have the same issues. They don't think the same about plagiarism and copyright and things that Americans do. So when we say we don't want you to take things directly from a website and stick it as your answer, we still find that they often will do that. And the response I get is like, oh, why should I write it in my terrible English when it's in beautiful English here? But there does seem to be less of a concern about, you know, what they present. Now, this is not all the students, but what they present. And I just wonder if that plays into this, even the perception of that plays into it, that we are likely to...
The cultural differences.
I mean, cultural difference.
I don't know. I taught journalism in China briefly, and had students who tried to say this was a cultural issue, and I just didn't. I think I tend to be suspicious of cultural essentialist arguments. I've heard people who, you know, from people who are not Chinese make that argument too.
Right.
You know, the truth is, if you go back centuries, there. Like to the 1700s to 1800s in the United States, this is a place of massive plagiarism and technologies, right? So Dickens famously came to visited America in the 1800s and was like shocked to find his books pirated everywhere.
So it could happen anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, I do think it's important to enforce norms around. Mm-hmm. Around copying and stealing, and you know, I do think it's important to enforce regulations around IP theft and grant fraud. I think the question is about how we do it and whether the punishment is commensurate with the crime. I should have foregrounded this all by saying that this has become a major national security issue for the FBI. It's one of their top priority next to counterterrorism. So that's the degree of importance that's being placed on it. And I think we do need to have a conversation about whether the US reaction is in proportion with what's happening. And so similar to after 9/11, like, is our response productive, or is it creating other problems?
And you raise plenty of questions about why it's a top issue for the FBI. Whether it's of importance to law, whether it's of importance to the economy, whether it's of importance because they already have the apparatus to do this and they need a new market. It's a whole complex story. And this narrative lays a lot of it out in the most interesting ways.
I get a lot of feedback. You know, I'll see it on Twitter or something, and people are like, I really enjoyed this book. And I thought that, you would think industrial espionage, well, we like our sort of spy novels and stuff. But I felt like, as you said, there's sort of some of the plans were sort of harebrained. So it's not like some, you know, mastermind spy going to do this. It's just someone got caught up in this and didn't see a way out. He needs the money to support his family. And, you know, so
and there's this American farmer caught in the middle, and then even after I don't want to give too much away, but when he ends up in prison, Robert is there with other very well-educated Chinese scientists, and so they end up playing ping pong together, talking about Chinese history. It's just like very well-read,
writing poetry.
Nice. And this is the state of our federal prisons system today. which I think bears some reflection.
Yeah. It's interesting. So, yeah, so I thought, I suppose it's always hard, but what was your favorite part of working on this book?
Well, you know, being from the Midwest and now living in the Midwest again, it was lovely to drive through small towns, and people were very welcoming. People in rural China are honestly very welcoming as well. I also had to grapple with racism and the rise of Trump and all these other things that were happening at the time that I was doing my reporting. And so it did give me a new perspective on the Midwest. But I think, you know, for me, I've got little kids, being able to report this story that was close to home, but it was also still global in scope. It was, that was really interesting.
That's interesting. And that's something for the reader too. That a question for a lot of the books that we talk about is like, do you feel like you're a different person after you've read the book? And I think the answer is yes. There are all these interesting questions and things that to think about and reflect on that seem valuable to think about that we wouldn't even have thought of before. Thank you.
That is probably a good time
for it. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, if you think about like The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, it's one of the books that you.
And so, yeah, I feel different having read this book now.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I loved it. Well, I was anticipating, you know, ever since I read Unnatural Selection, I've been like, oh, great, you know, wonderful. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to a new book. So do you have another book in mind, or it's too soon to think about another book?
I do, but the world is changing so fast. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to write a book no matter what, but I think what it's about, we'll see.
Wow. Well, you know, before we sign off, I wonder if there's anything else you wanted to add that maybe we didn't cover and you thought was important to say on anything, your book or whatever.
I don't know. You know, okay. People in this time period, if people do take to reading and we're all a little bit cooped up at home, I think, you know, it's a great.
They but should choose your book.
There's an audiobook version of the book that I read part of it. And
I heard two. Very fun to work. I heard there were two, you and some other narrators.
I read the first person chapters.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Wonderful. So, are you reading anything right now?
I'm reading a lot of news.
I know, me too. I'm like, I'm not getting...
I'm going to tear myself away and dive into a really good book because I think,
Yeah, I feel like my, I've slowed down on reading a full book because I just can't tear myself away from the computer. So I should though.
So. Yeah. I've been reading Leslie Jamison's essays though, which are just
great. Good idea. So, all right. Well, I guess, you know, it's been wonderful to have you here. It has been absolutely wonderful to have you here and to finally speak to you after being a fan of your work and so glad that such a wonderful writer as you is out there, a good, great journalist who can get to, to the bottom of a story and you know, tell it in such a way that we can enjoy it. Like I said, very enjoyable. So we've been talking to Mara Hispendahl and about her book, The Scientist and the Spy. And definitely, as Mara said, if you're cooped up these days, I think this is a good book to read. So, great.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. And we'll talk to you again next time on Read Science.
All right. Thanks. Bye.